Heading to CBC? Make sure to stop by booth 1989 to chat with the Brewbound team, check out our live podcast recordings, and find out about Brewbound's upcoming events. Have news to submit ahead of the show? Head to brewbound.com/submitnews to let us know about your latest updates.
Welcome to the Brewbound podcast. I'm Justin Kendall, the editor of Brewbound, and I'm joined in the Brewbound podcast studio by BevNet editor-in-chief Jeff Kleinman, who is so excited to talk about After Midnight and the Michelob brand.
We're going to let it all hang out tonight there, Justin. And speaking of letting it all hang out, I hear you had a big weekend.
Oh, a huge weekend, going to the movies and avoiding being in the cold.
Do you know what I would give to go to one sweet, sweet movie? But I can't. I'm not allowed to.
You're not allowed to go to Terminator Dark Fate?
Well, no. Although I did take my kid to see The Matrix when it was re-released a few months ago. So I could probably get him down to see some Terminator. But no, he has not yet enjoyed the Arnold.
Yeah. Well, Arnold was enjoying Mexican beers, although they were suspiciously not Coronas. They look like Coronas, but they were not Coronas. Even slicing the lime.
Well, perhaps Arnold was representing for all of California.
Then he would be drinking Modelo. That is the top-selling beer in California.
It is, and Arnold, as we know, was at one point the top vote-getter in California. But, I mean, what does a beer do to the Terminator's circuits?
He's fine. He's absolutely fine.
He's indestructible. I bet a good stone would just knock him out.
He is the original robot that does not feel.
He does feel a little bit.
He's starting to come around on feeling, but he originally did not feel.
It's true. He felt no pain. One of the things that's amazing about a growing industry like craft beer is that you get these kind of side businesses that come into it. And I think that at least for half this episode, we're going to hear about a fun one, huh?
Right. This week, we're doing another double episode recorded on site at the Great American Beer Festival. I got a chance to catch up with Crystal K. Wiebe from Beer Paws. She founded that company. They make dog treats from spent grain.
That sounds amazing. Have you tried them?
I have not, but Dusty, my dog, has, and he approves.
That's great. Has Arnold tried them?
I did not see them in Terminator Dark Fate.
Well,
you would think that this podcast is brought to you by Terminator Dark Fate.
But unfortunately, we have no sponsors.
I interview Crystal as well as Bob Pease, the president and CEO of the Brewers Association.
Also a guy who has a great job due to the growth of the craft beer industry.
Exactly. So this really turns into a state of the industry discussion. Bob and I look back at trends in 2019 and where the business is headed in 2020, which apparently I will also be heading to puberty with my voice cracking there.
It's a long, tough journey, but I think you'll find it very rewarding on the other side, Justin.
I dream of it. Let's go to our first interview with Crystal K. Wiebe, the founder of Beer Paws. This is Justin Kendall for the Brewbound podcast, and I'm joined today at the Great American Beer Festival by Beer Paws founder Crystal K. Wiebe. Crystal, for our listeners out there who might not be familiar with Beer Paws, but I'm sure they probably have seen your tent here at the Great American Beer Fest if they've attended. Give them a little rundown of what Beer Paws does.
Sure. So it all started with a bottle opener for your dog's collar. That's officially what a beer paw is. And I started selling those, and people thought that was fun and cute, and part of it benefited animal rescue. And they were like, what else can you do with dogs and drinking? Which led me down a rabbit hole a little over 6 years ago. And since that time, I've been working with breweries all over the country, a lot of them in Kansas City, to use their spent grains and turn them into a yummy dog treat. And we do a dog beer too, because you can't have a company called Beer Paws without one, right?
Mm-hmm.
So all kinds of fun stuff for the four-legged drinking buddy.
So you essentially run a bakery for dogs.
I do. I do. But we have a short recipe list.
Well, I've seen a few different flavors.
Yeah.
Like, I think there was like a pumpkin spice one.
Yeah. So. Yeah. And so we'll have here at GABF our core flavors, our peanut butter, which is our original that we move the most of because most dogs, peanut butter, duh. And then our pumpkin spice is our second most popular flavor. And I do have some other specialties that we do in shorter runs. And one that I'm really excited about that we do that's those two exact same flavors, but they're gluten-free, which we make in partnership with Martin City Brewing Company over in Kansas City out of a gluten-free beer. So we can do some fun stuff. We do some beet treats once in a while. And I just, we haven't even formally announced everything, but I just began sharing a location and sharing my bakery equipment with another Kansas City-based dog treat company called Barkville Bakery. And so we're working together on some really fun stuff, and we'll have some teasers here actually at GABF, some of our first collaboration products. So there will be more flavors.
So you started the business 6 years ago. How did you know, or how did you even think up getting into making treats from spent grain?
So, you know, I've been thinking about this a lot because the first home brewer that ever gave me spent grains was kind of a big deal in the Kansas City area, Michael Wells, and he recently passed away, and that's been really, really emotional for everyone kind of in the scene there. And I think back, I figured out that the next product that I should do beyond this bottle opener should be this dog treat. And I think I connected with some homebrewer group on Facebook, and someone kind of made the introduction for me and put the word out. And then I had like homebrewers started reaching out to me, and I started experimenting because I saw that, you know, there were some recipes out there that some homebrewers were doing it just for their own dogs and whatnot. And I was like, gosh, there aren't that many people. No one is really making dog treats, spent grain dog treats on a larger scale. So maybe there's some opportunity here. But it was just a fun passion hobby for me. I'm a crazy dog lady, so I've always had doggies.
So how do you turn that from, you know, hobby to this is a full-time gig for you?
Yeah. So really it was just volume and just hitting the ground. My background involved a lot of knowing about events and some event planning. And so from the beginning, I started popping up at beer festivals and other kinds of local events and selling things there. And I just kept really busy and tried to develop a eye-catching, good brand. And I've just worked it so hard that enough people in my region got to know who I was. And it wasn't too long after I started working with homebrewers that then small breweries would contact me and say, hey, would you like to work with us? Could you use some of our spent grains? And then it just kind of snowballed. Mm-hmm. And so I tag teamed. I was based in Kansas City, as I have been for the duration of this business, but I'm a Nebraska native. So I reached out to breweries in Nebraska very early on. And that's been really key, was getting my legs under me in multiple regions. And over time, we developed some pretty cool relationships with breweries in Oklahoma and Arkansas and, you know, a smattering of other places.
About how many breweries would you say that you work with now?
I would say with breweries that we have kind of consistent relationships with, I would say we're at about 40 to 50.
Mm-hmm.
And when I say consistent, you know, everyone does a different level of relationship or sales. So it might be, they might order dog treats and we might work with them a couple of times a year, or, you know, Boulevard keeps their gift shop stocked with our treats throughout the year. And we do a lot of stuff with them, or with Kansas City Beer Company. It just,
was that a big get for you when you got stocked in the Boulevard gift shop?
Yeah, that was pretty exciting. I remember kind of how that came together earlier on in my business. I was doing the 1 million cups circuit. And I don't know, some of your listeners might know, it's a place where startups go to share their story. And I did this in several cities, and of course in Kansas City, where 1 million cups started as well. And the day that I spoke there, I remember the like Twitter boards and the screens behind me going off because people in the audience were tweeting at Boulevard, hey, you need to work with her, you need to work with her. And it wasn't, I think it was like 2 weeks later or something that happened. And to be honest, getting the Boulevard account and noticing that they were ordering regularly was one of the key factors that gave me the courage to step away from my full-time job in corporate America mm-hmm. and give this whole dog treat thing a go.
I was going to say, at what point in sort of your business's life cycle did you really realize that you could, you know, jump in and do it full-time, or that you wanted to, you know, make it a full-time job?
So I knew within less than a year that I wanted it to be a full-time thing. Really, when it started, I didn't envision it as that at all. I really thought I was just going to have these like cute bottle openers that I sold in addition to like promoting my blog about rescuing dogs. And so it just kind of spun out. But once it started, I did also kind of fall in love with the festival and the event part of it. And so when I started to realize that I could travel and take my dog treats and this baby brand that I was building on the road to other places, then that I wanted to do that all the time and not be stuck at my 9-to-5 job. And then I simultaneously started building up some accounts, and it just got to be too much. I was staying up all night long baking dog treats and doing all the things. And if I had gigs in Nebraska, I would leave so early in the morning and be gone all weekend and try to come back and do an 8-hour, you know, be functional and worthwhile at my 9-to-5. I really lucked out though when I finally kind of hit that breaking point, was like, I can't do this anymore. The company that I worked for was phenomenal, and I was able to do kind of a gradual step down over 6 to 8 months, where I went from full-time to part-time at home and then hourly, always setting my own hours. Then, as it turned out, the company changed and they technically eliminated my position, and I got some severance, which also helped. So that was...
It worked out for everyone.
Yes, that was wonderful for everyone. So that also gave me kind of like a little bit of a false, I don't want to say sense of security, but it... Yeah, I had a little bit more of a security net there for about a year and a half. And so since then, I've been learning, I wouldn't say more quickly, but some of the lessons have hurt a little bit more. And, you know, that's part of being an entrepreneur. And for me, figuring things out as I go.
Mm-hmm.
Year 6 feels a lot different.
Yeah, I imagine it does. But, you know, in the early days when you were doing this all in your home kitchen, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. So it started on just a regular old oven, and I didn't have a mixer at that time. I think I had a hand mixer that I broke, and so I would mix literally with my hand and a big wooden spoon in this great big steel bowl.
You and Charlie Papazian.
Yeah.
Maybe your spoon will also make it to the Smithsonian.
I hope so, if only. Well, the best part was, as I was figuring out what shape and how to make these treats. And it takes a long time. Spent grain dog treats have to bake a long time. It's not easy or really that fun. Like, it's totally a passion. But I didn't know how I wanted them to look. And so I was experimenting. And I was like, well, maybe I'll roll them out and make them like bars. And I realized legit didn't have a bottle opener, but I had like unlabeled bottles that homebrewers had given me. So some of the very first like experimental beer paws were rolled out with a beer bottle. So... Huh. Keeping it classy.
Yeah.
Malt Europe Malting Company is North American proud with premium grains from field to flavor. Our selections include base, specialty, and distillers malt varieties. Stop by our booth, 2143, at the Craft Brewers Conference in Vegas. Does your brewing software suck? We've heard it from thousands of brewers. Connect with Ollie today and we'll buy out your current contract and hook you up with brewing software that doesn't suck. Visit booth 1685 at CBC or hit getollie.com/pod.
So at what point did you sort of take it to the next level and mm-hmm. make the investment that you needed to, you know, get industrial-sized ovens, and I imagine they were also still in your own kitchen?
They sure were. So within that first year, I actually got involved with a sort of startup accelerator program. That's when I started to really take things seriously and see the possibilities of it, and really it started more than anything, that experience boosted my confidence. What's crazy is the very first week of those classes, I started chatting with another entrepreneur there who has a hummus company, and he had a pair of industrial ovens that he didn't need and he had just inherited in a space that he had taken over. And so I bought those ovens like right out the gate, but they sat in my garage for a couple of years before I was in a position where I had kind of a support system around me that could help me figure out how to install giant ovens in my house. So the ovens got put in a couple years in like November or something. And I remember joining my parents on a trip to Hawaii and going to the bathroom at Kona Brewing Company and walking past their kitchen and looking up, and they had the exact same Blodgett ovens as me. And I totally like teared up and I was like, oh my gosh, I feel like a real business person. It was so goofy. So then within another year and a half, you know, we were really needing more than two ovens. So I found kind of a deal on another pair of commercial ovens. So we hooked those up in my kitchen. The original ones were in my dining room. And somewhere along the lines, a restaurant closed and gave me an oven, which we still haven't hooked up, but I still have it for backup. It's that old heap in the corner. Mm-hmm. So, and then just a few weeks ago, we were finally able to, I was finally able to get into a situation. Another local dog treat company, Barkville Bakery, contacted me, and we'd been kind of working around the local pet community for a while together and gotten to know one another. And she really wants to take her business to the next step. And I really needed a space to work out of, and she found one, and there are no longer giant ovens in my house.
Year six.
Yeah, year six.
It's a slow climb.
Yes.
To...
it's a really slow climb. And I think all the time people get that wrong, or they think, oh man, someone's been at it. I feel like there's this pervasive idea that, oh, if a business doesn't, quote, make it, which what is that, in 2 years or 3 years or 5 years, then it's done. But then there's, you see so many businesses, I meet so many entrepreneurs who've been at it and hitting it hard for 6, 8, 10 years, and they still have something really beautiful that they're passionate about. You know, it might be a $500,000 a year business. It might be $1 million a year business. It just, I don't know, like life is short, do what you want.
How do you keep that flame sort of burning through that time? Because I know that it's not easy to be a startup. I mean, I'm sure there's hundreds of craft brewers here who mm-hmm. could tell you the same story. And we've seen, you know, as growth has slowed down, you know, it's gotten dicey for a lot of folks. You
Absolutely.
Know, and we've seen the number of closings uptick. So how do you sort of keep that flame burning?
Mm-hmm. That's an excellent question. I've definitely had some serious moments in the past 12 months and more in the past 6 months where things have happened in my life personally, where I had to sit and shake my head and be like, what are you doing? And feel like, gosh, you're just putting all of your energies into this thing. What's been really helpful for me recently is figuring out that I need a buddy in this. Mm-hmm. And connecting with my friend Kayla with Barkville Bakery has like reignited me so hard, because I feel like there's someone else, even though we have two separate businesses, but we're working together, just there's someone else that I'm working with on a day-to-day basis who gets it, and we're both running at this thing together, and there's someone to share it with. Whereas I think I've been stuck in a rut at different points and a lot in the past year where I was just kind of boxed myself in this little like lone entrepreneur myth, and like you need people around you. And I am so blessed that I've had a really supportive family and friends around me the whole time. I mean, this is the fourth year I brought my mom to Great American Beer Festival. I mean, she's like got to be the coolest mom out there. But my parents have been really fantastic, and just, you know, close friends of kind of keeping me on it and reminding me, you know, this is, you're doing this for a reason. It's okay.
Yeah. How important is it to Beer Paws to be at the Great American Beer Fest? What does that do for your business?
So that's an interesting one too. For me, I feel like it's really good for Beer Paws to be at Great American Beer Festival, because it shows that although we were making dog treats out of my own kitchen for a long time, this isn't just a like side hobby thing. Like I want to be, and I want Beer Paws to be seen as the company that breweries would choose to go to have spent grain dog treats. Like we have worked with more breweries than I believe any other dog treat company that is doing this. And so I feel like for me, it's being up on that stage. And also it's super important to get in front of like the consumers that come to GABF. Mm-hmm. Obviously those are my consumers. Those are my people. And there's more of them here at one time than any other festival or anything that I could go to. So it's just where my people are.
Yeah. For an entrepreneur who is looking to get into a business that is sort of beer adjacent, mm-hmm. you've been in this for 6 years now. What advice would you give to them?
Whatever you're offering, make sure that it's that you can back up the value that it offers to the brewers. If you're coming at it like I am with a, you know, a product, one of the ways that was great for us and that I'm seeing some other companies that not doing the same thing as us, but like, you know, candles, for example, position yourself so that you're an ally for the breweries, not so that, you know, it seems like you're just kind of like piggybacking on craft beer. And so some of the companies that I talk to and who have products that I'm excited about definitely are positioning themselves that way. And, you know, they're legitimately interested in craft beer. It's not just about the dollars. That makes sense.
Yeah. And you've got a legitimate interest because it sounds like you really wanted to hit the festival circuit.
Yeah. I really love the festivals. I mean, I would, in an ideal world, and my family is always like, you don't want to be this vendor, like a carnival barker your whole life, do you? And I'm like, not really, but I do really enjoy the festivals, you know, definitely the beer festivals more than anything, but also to a little bit lesser extent, some of the pet events where I can be one-to-one with the people that are ultimately taking this product home to feed their dog and enjoy this moment. But on the beer festival circuit, the thing from the beginning, I always viewed Beer Paws as this small little extension in some ways of the breweries where, you know, we sell our treats. If people want to, they can have them stickered with the breweries that we work with. And so it's a co-branded product. And so I do love to have those conversations at the table about the breweries or be like, if we're at an event where we have all stickered co-branded products, then I can be like, oh, hey, you know, we have this deal, bundle deal going on. Pick out your two or three products and people will go through and pick them by brewery. And I love to have those conversations and introduce them to new breweries. I've always kind of viewed my company and when I have helpers, like our the reps, as folks who are out there helping to get the word out and market these breweries because they're my friends.
Awesome. Well, thanks for sharing your story with us today, Crystal. I appreciate the time.
Thank you for having me on here, Justin.
Absolutely. Cheers.
Cheers.
Okay, that was our interview with Crystal K. Wiebe. Jeff, thoughts?
Certainly was a treat. Come on, spit it out.
I know. I thought it would be interesting to interview someone who's in a beer adjacent business. And as Bob Pease is going to tell us in the next interview, the craft beer industry generated $79.1 billion in economic impact. And some of that's coming from businesses like Crystal's.
Well, that's a lot of kibble. I'm glad that there are treats for all of us.
Indeed there are. I guess we should just go to our other interview with Bob Pease of the beer industry. Here you go. This is Justin Kendall for the Brewbound podcast, and I'm joined today by Bob Pease, the president and CEO of the Brewers Association. And we're here on the eve of the Great American Beer Festival. Bob, let's talk about the state of the industry. We've seen sort of some turbulence in the market this year. We've seen the number of closings rise, although openings are still outpacing closings. We've seen a number of big deals this year, you know, Platform acquired by ABI, Dogfish Head merging with Boston Beer. So when you reflect on 2019, and I know we're only in October, but when you reflect on this year, how are you going to look back on this year for craft brewers?
Well, that's a large one. 2019 will be similar to 2018 and 2017. There will be overall growth in volume for small and independent craft brewers. Much of that growth, though, driven by new entrants and also the smallest of the small, the really local business model. We'll see close to 1,000 openings, similar in the last than the last few years. But the number of closings will be the highest it's probably ever been. We're projecting right now somewhere in the neighborhood of 300 closings. So openings still far outpacing closings, but up to 300 closings is now what we're predicting for 2019. Then the other thing you have to really look at for 2019 is, you know, it's kind of been in the brewing community, and you know this as well as I do, it's kind of been the year of the seltzer, right? I mean, mm-hmm. It's the year of hard seltzer. And what does that mean for the future of our members, for the Brewers Association, for the Great American Beer Festival? Interesting times for sure. But, you know, I think this is all part of the maturation of the craft brewing community and the craft brewing movement. It's nothing to be upset about. It's something to lean into and to be embraced. Small and independent brewers, 13.2% of the market by volume, 25% by dollars. So, I mean, very solid industry, $79.1 billion in economic impact across the country. So a lot to be proud of and a lot of change on the horizon.
At last count, I think that there were 7,500 breweries. Is that where we are now, or have we crossed 8,000?
I think that's the number we're using publicly. it goes up each and every day. I'm sure it's a little north of 7,500, but we have not hit 8,000 yet.
Okay.
But that is very, it's going to be close for 2019.
Do you see that number, and we talk about openings continuing to go up while closings is also sort of closing the gap, but not there yet. Do you see that number eventually hitting 10,000? And I don't know why people sort of throw that out there as like the magic number, but that seems to be the magic number a lot of people throw out.
We're starting to see the first signs of slowing down in openings. We're seeing that in terms of, you know, the number of brewery and planning members we have at the Brewers Association, which is somewhere close to 2,000. So that means, you know, we have close to 2,000 members who have not even opened the doors yet. I think 9,000 breweries is a virtual certainty. After that, I don't know where it's going to go. I mean, in some cases, people like to talk about saturation, but, you know, we know we have over 10,000 wineries in this country, and small and independent brewers only have 13.2% of the market. So, I mean, there's certainly room for growth still with 7,500 breweries in operation.
And is it sustainable to keep adding? I mean, if we hit 10,000, is it going to be a sustainable number?
I think that depends on the business model that you want to operate when you open your brewery. If you want to focus on a taproom brewery and with food trucks, and you know, if that's permissible by law, that is absolutely a sustainable business. Will you be able to scale that business to a distribution model where you're working with a distributor and, you know, putting your beers into bottle cans or kegs? That's another story. It is certainly much harder now to operate in the distribution or the packaging brewery model, which we know 10 years ago there was two business models basically, right? There was a packaging brewer or there was a pub brewer. Well, now there's that third element of the taproom brewer, and so that is certainly sustainable, but you know, it has a certain ceiling that it's going to be hard to break through.
So for those potential brewers out there, those people who are still looking at the market and saying, yeah, I want to get in, I want to be a brewery owner, what advice would you give to them?
Your motivation to get into this community needs to be fueled by passion, first and foremost. You can make a profitable and healthy living if you have world-class beer, top-notch service, a great environment. But the bar is set so much higher now than it was even 3 years ago. You'd better have world-class liquid in order to compete. So passion, a focus on quality, and a focus on people would be my three main points of advice for a new entrance into the market.
For the people who do get in the industry, are you seeing a lot of people hitting on those three things? Or do you think that there are some people who maybe you're a little too starry-eyed?
You know, it's a mixed bag, right? You go to a lot of breweries, as do I. And like anything in the service industry or the food and beverage industry, you see the gamut. but I love going into new breweries and talking to brewery owners and seeing what motivated them to get into the industry. And I love to talk with them about the resources that the Brewers Association has to help them be, you know, a more sustainable business and a business that can have legs and moving into the future.
Yeah. You mentioned hard seltzer, and it's been nearly a year since the BA changed its definition of what a craft brewer is, dropping the traditional pillar. And so that really seems to have opened up a playbook for a lot of brewers beyond even hard seltzer. I mean, we're seeing canned cocktails, kombucha, tea, cider, you name it. And I'm probably missing some in there. When you look back on that move, how do you reflect on that change?
Well, I think you look back a year ago, and I think that decision to alter or modify the craft brewer definition was a fairly insightful one by our board of directors. You know, I don't think our changing the definition is the reason a small and independent brewery is making a hard seltzer personally. I think that's what small and independent brewers are doing to try to stay competitive, to try to respond to the marketplace where, you know, there's a segment of the population that wants to drink products that are, you know, beer alternatives. And, you know, our business at the Brewers Association is trying to help small and independent brewers compete and then be successful. And so if the definition change had a small element to that success, then we're happy about that.
It certainly would seem, though, that sort of opened the floodgates, or at least people felt more comfortable with making those moves, having sort of the blessing of the BA.
They knew they would not fall outside the craft brewer definition. I like hearing that. I mean, I guess I like to think that we're humble at the Brewers Association and, you know, to think that people were watching us that closely. But I guess you're right. But we're talking to breweries now that, you know, the hard seltzer is upwards of 10, 15, 20% of their, you know, their total volume. And they need that flexibility in order to compete. It's a tough market out there. It's incredibly challenging and competitive to get shelf space. It's very difficult to get your beers on tap. So if this is something, exploring into alternative beverages is something that makes it a little bit easier for small and independent brewers, so be it.
And there's a lot of excess capacity out there, too, that this is helping fill up.
Sure is, yes.
And you mentioned possible evolution of GABF. And, we've seen this opening of the playbook. You know, we've seen a lot of brewers move into these other beyond beer, I guess is the catch-all term for it. So is there an opportunity for these products to be featured on the floor of GABF? And is it going to sort of come to something where we're going to see maybe a hard seltzer category or something like that in the judging of GABF?
Anything's possible. We like to think of ourselves as trying to continue to evolve as the craft brewing or the overall beer community evolves. I would think hard seltzers or kombuchas or alternative beverages being on the festival floor is more likely initially than for it to be a competition category to be created. But we want to remain relevant to the beer drinker and to the consumer. So while no decisions have been made yet, those conversations are taking place right now, like I said, with our brewers, our events committee and the board of directors. And so I would think some type of either a pavilion or allowing every brewery who enters into the festival to bring one alternative beverage, I think is probably where we'll head. But again, no decisions have been made yet.
So we could see something potentially like the Jameson Beer Garden, but for these other Beyond Beer products.
Yeah, that's one option we are discussing. And the another option we're discussing is just to allow every brewery that has space on the floor to bring one non-beer product.
Gotcha. One of the things that's also sort of surprised me as sort of a byproduct of this is that there are a number of companies out there, breweries, who are now saying, I'm no longer a brewery, I'm a beverage company.
Yeah.
And it's a little surprising to me. I heard Michael Lalonde, the CEO of Deschutes, say that. I spoke with Rob Burns recently of Night Shift. He mentioned that they're a beverage company. Garrett Marrero from Maui has said that. Even Canarchy, And I mean, there are a lot of big breweries that are sort of considering themselves in this category. What do you think of that distinction?
Those are the people who I work for. So I want to be supportive. You know, I'm a bit of a traditionalist, I think. For me, there's so much, you know, romance and history and culture tied into beer. It's harder for me to get my arms around, you know, the Beyond Beer products. But at the same time, the contributions that these companies have made to their local communities, their states, and even to our national culture is really significant. And so we're going to find a way to be supportive of that at the end of the day.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's definitely one of those things where it just sort of catches you and you're like, okay, well, I mean, what does this sort of open up and where does this go from here?
Yeah, I mean, there's, you know, are hard seltzers, you know, are they the hard sodas of yesteryear or are they the next light beer? They certainly seem to have a lot more staying power than the hard sodas did of a couple of years back. If you look at some of the capital investment commitments that are being made to make more capacity to put more seltzer on the shelf, it looks like it's here to stay.
And it's definitely hitting on, you know, this healthy lifestyle, better for you trend that's out there. And I don't know if it was, I think it was 2 years ago, Paul Gatza had mentioned this on the stage that you might want to consider moving into sort of a better for you type beverage. And at the time, it didn't register with me.
Yeah.
And now it definitely is like, wow, Paul must have had a crystal ball.
Yeah, Paul's a very smart man. You know, there's a lot of smart people on our board of directors, and we've been having these discussions, you know, for more than just a year. It's been, you know, 3 years at least, you know, as we've been discussing, you know, how breweries making Beyond Beer products, how they fit into the craft brewer definition, if they didn't fit, all of those things. So we've been having those conversations for some time. All I can say is we're happy to see our members have another way to compete. And if Beyond Beer products are it, we'll find a way to adjust.
But it is something, like you said, it doesn't seem to have the same sort of romance to it. You could with distilling, yes,
yeah.
But with hard seltzer, I can't imagine that there are a lot of people who sort of want to see how the seltzer is made, you know,
yeah.
Or...
I mean, brewing 9,000 years of, you know, of history, right? I mean, and then with, you know, either a flavored malt beverage or a flavored sugar beverage or sucrose, it's a little tougher, again, for me to get my arms around the cultural significance of these products, but it's what some segment of the beer drinking or the above legal age drinker wants to explore right now.
Mm-hmm.
So that's part of the excitement. You know, small independent brewers have always prided themselves on innovation. It's always been one of our buzzwords and being nimble and being responsive to the market. And I think this is just another example of that.
So when you look at the landscape of craft and innovation, what is out there in beer that is exciting you these days?
Boy, you know, I really think there's an opportunity for small and independent brewers to play in the space that's traditionally been held by the, you know, the larger multinational brewers in terms of style. And by that, I mean, you know, lagers, pilsners, Helles. I mean, there's a brewery here in, you know, downtown Denver, Bierstadt Lagerhaus, that I had the opportunity to visit earlier this week. And, you know, I mean, those beers are just so delicious. And they're a little bit lighter in alcohol and a little bit lighter in calories. And so I think that's an opportunity for small and independent brewers. Sours are still certainly something of interest, but, you know, I think it's hard for most beer drinkers to have more than, you know, one or two sours, where light lager, traditional lager, great style, and, you know, still underrepresented in the craft segment.
So on the flip side of that, I would say, what do you see as the biggest challenges facing craft breweries today?
Ooh, well, the myriad of, there's a lot of challenges out there, as you know. We read a lot of the same publications, I'm sure, and you hear a lot of stuff about, oh, you know, everybody, you know, everyone above legal drinking age is drinking less alcohol. Well, that's not really true. Alcohol consumption has stayed pretty static over the last 5, 10, 15 years. But, you know, the challenges, it again, depends on your business model. But, you know, for a small independent brewer right now, there's the challenge of the unknown of the federal excise tax situation. Are their excise tax going to double on a small and independent brewer from $3.50 to $7 per barrel? You have the challenges of the tariffs on aluminum and steel and, you know, federal trade policy and how will that impact small and independent brewers. I lump both of those challenges in just one, the word of uncertainty. It's very difficult to operate a small business when you're not certain what your hard costs are going to be. Then there's the challenge of, you know, if you're a brewery that's, 10, 20, 30 years old, working with your distributor partner, if you're a distributing brewery, getting attention from your distributor partner to get your beers on the shelf or on the tap. That is incredibly more and more challenging each and every day. You know, the number of legitimate beer distribution options continues to decline. The number of breweries continues to explode, but most of those breweries now are not looking for a distributor partner. But if they want that distributor partner, those, you know, that landscape has really shifted where, you know, 5 years ago, distributors were looking to acquire as many interesting new brands as possible. Well, those days are not, that's not happening right now.
Not to mention the tier is shrinking.
Yes. And we lump that challenge into what we call access to market. You know, it is hard for the small guy who does not have economies of scale in any industry to compete with the larger players in the segment. You know, that's one of the things that we always are, you know, fighting for at the Brewers Association is access to market and trying to make sure that the playing field is as level as possible. You've heard us use this phrase before, and this is another, you know, challenge is what we call the illusion of choice, where, you know, what is on tap or what is on the shelf is artificially influenced by the two largest players in our segment, instead of letting the beer drinker decide, you know, what is, you know, on tap or on the shelf. You know, we want consumer pull to be the determining factor of what the beer drinker gets to make a decision on, not what we call supplier push, when the supplier is determining to the retailer what's on the shelf or what's on tap.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned craft beverage modernization. How optimistic are you that it's going to at least get extended for, I think, a year or 2 years?
Yeah, we're in there pitching each and every day. It is the number one federal affairs priority for the Brewers Association. Our level of support for the bill in the Congress is outstanding. You know, very appreciative to the support that we get from Congress. 288 co-sponsors on the House bill, literally 144 Republicans, 144 Democrats co-sponsoring the bill. So the bill could not be any more bipartisan. The Senate bill has 70 co-sponsors, so it's already passed a supermajority. I think the level of support there is 34 R's, 35 D's, and one independent. So again, bipartisan, bicameral, but the number of co-sponsors does not get your bill passed. You know, we need there to be meaningful legislation. We need there to be tax, some type of at least tax or tax-related legislation, and then we need to be part of that legislation. How confident am I, you know, with Washington? Anybody that tells you that they know what's going to happen in Washington, run away from them, because I can tell you nobody knows what's going to happen in Washington. I am confident that we have done everything that we possibly can to be put in the best position possible for the bill to be extended or made permanent.
I mean, things could change with a 240-character tweet.
Yes. I hope I never get on the subject of one of those.
You might with this tax reform bill, man. The Brewers Association has done a lot of work in regards to diversity and inclusion.
Yeah.
And you guys, I believe earlier this week, in early October, when this is recorded, you guys started accepting applications for diversity and inclusion event grants. I think you guys gave out $20,000 last year?
That's correct, yes.
What did you learn from, when we say last year, I mean 2019,
yeah.
But what did you learn from that first round of grants?
We learned there's an incredible amount of excitement and energy around our ability to fund that. You know, we're super proud of the work that we're doing in the diversity space. You know, one of my mentors, you know, said to me one time, you know, diversity is not a topic or an issue to be solved, but rather it's more of a value to be lived. And so we're trying to take that into heart with everything we do. The diversity grants, you know, we're still compiling all of the results from the recipients of the 2019, for the grants in 2019, but we know it's been successful. And I know we're going to double at least the amount of funding for events in 2020.
When you look at that diversity and inclusion work, how do you sort of define success in that area?
Well, we did a benchmark study on statistics. And, you know, it didn't tell us anything we didn't already know.
Primarily we know the bars,
in terms of improvement, the bar is very low, right? I mean, it's white males, by and large, dominating the community. And so we're going to do everything we can to try to, you know, bring new beer drinkers into the space, you know, women, minorities, you know. And it's funny to me because, you know, everybody that I meet in the craft brewing community, and I think back as Sam, you know, craft brewing is 99% asshole free. I can't think of a community that's more welcoming to all types of people from all walks of life. But, you know, listening to our diversity ambassador, Dr. J, speak, you know, you realize, hey, just because what's in your heart might be what you think is what everyone should be thinking about, if you have to be able to try to put yourself into a minority's shoes and, you know, look at it from her or his perspective and, you know, hey, do they feel welcome in our community? And so lots of room for improvement. We'll continue to survey the community to see if we can, you know, reach some of those objectives of bringing new beer drinkers into the space and also have perhaps greater degree of minority ownership for small and independent breweries as well.
What does the next 5 years for craft brewers look like?
Oh, I see continued growth for small and independent craft brewers. I see us getting to 10,000 breweries within 5 years in the United States. I see the number of closings continue to go up, which, you know, is not necessarily altogether negative. You hate to see anybody not be successful when they go all in as a small business owner, but some type of economic Darwinism so that the quality bar continues to rise, continues to excel. I see small and independent brewers continuing to celebrate legislative successes in Washington, D.C., and I see the Brewers Association continue to be the leading voice for beer in this country.
Well, Bob, any final thoughts you want to leave our listeners with?
Oh, I think, you know, your listeners know this as well as we do, Justin, but the positive contribution that I'm always struck by this, the positive contribution that these small and independent businesses make every day in their local community, the state, and across the country really is what motivates me to work in this community. I mean, and Dogfish Head's maybe not an easy example to go to, but, you know, they do their Dogfish Dash, and, you know, they raise $185,000 for the Nature Conservancy in Delaware. And they put it out there on social media. Yeah, they tweet about it, but they don't make that big of a deal out of it. And that's kind of the DNA that we see across, you know, all 7,500 small and independent craft breweries. And, you know, it just makes me really incredibly proud to be part of it.
Awesome. Well, thanks for the time, Bob. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure. Likewise, Justin. Enjoy Great American Beer Festival 2019.
Cheers.
Cheers.
That was our interview with Bob Pease of the BA. Jeff, thoughts?
You really seemed interested in looking back on 2019 as well as that look forward. Are you surprised that they plan to open up GABF to these other sort of beyond beer options?
Nothing's for certain, but I'm not surprised at all, especially after they changed the definition of a craft brewer.
Do you think there will be a dog treat category?
There will never be a dog treat category.
What about Tide Pods?
Oh, I think you're having some Tide Pods. I'm really curious to see how they sort of walk the line between whether it's each table being able to offer a Beyond Beer offering or whether they have just a pavilion like they do with a whole Jameson Caskmates area.
Well, I think it's both great for the industry that people are pouring their creativity into these other product types. And, you know, it seems like one of these ongoing tensions is whether or not you're going too far from beer. And as a beer lover, I'd like to drink that. And I wonder if maybe it's not better off done at a separate event.
You could even hear the tension from Bob when I asked him what his thoughts were with all of these companies calling themselves beverage companies now. And he was very, you know, measured and I guess political.
Well, as
he should be, but you can tell that even he has some reservations about where things are headed. And at the same time, they have to be open to these other types of products that beer companies are making now.
The whole total beverage thing, I think, came into sharp relief a few weeks after this discussion when Molson Coors said it was really expanding its own purview to include the Beyond Beer type products and look more as a total beverage company.
Yeah, and they're going to change their name in 2020 to the Molson Coors Beverage Company. So that just really shows where this industry is heading right now and where even the second largest U.S. brewer, where their head's at.
Well, they better be careful or else they'll get bought up by Iams.
And this episode has been brought to you by BarkBox. All right, that's our show this week. Thanks for tuning in. We are available on iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, Google Play, Libsyn, and SoundCloud, at least for now. If you enjoyed the show, leave us a rating and review and share the podcast with your friends and colleagues and four-legged friends, apparently. I think that's where we're headed.
How many breweries have, like, the brewery dog running around? You've been to hundreds of breweries, right?
Mm-hmm. Oh, I don't know. I think it depends on state law in a lot of ways.
Who's your favorite brewery dog?
I don't have a favorite brewery dog.
It's very objective and measured.
Yes, I try and play it straight.
I can see the lies coming off you right as we sit here. Feel better, Joe.
Indeed. Drop us a line at podcast@brewbound.com if you'd like to be featured on the podcast or share your thoughts. Thank you to our audio team, our guests, Crystal K. Wiebe and Bob Pease, and all our listeners out there. Catch us next week for episode 6, the final episode of season 2. Until then, cheers.
Cheers.